This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hi, guys. Thanks for tuning in to the Friday Reporter podcast. I'm Lisa, your host, and this podcast is in partnership with PR Daily. PR Daily is a great resource for communicators like me. I drop in there to get my training, to get more information about what's going on in the industry, and really just to learn more about what my colleagues are up to as well. So to find more episodes of the podcast, please join me there at prdaily.com or join me at the website, which is fridayreporter.com. And if you like the show, be sure to leave a review on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts, because that really helps get the word out about the podcast and the work that we're doing here to get you guys to know more about the reporters that cover your industry. Well, hello, and thank you so much for joining me for another episode of the Friday Reporter podcast. Today's episode is with my good friend, Susan Crabtree, who is the White House and national political correspondent for Real Clear Politics. Susan, thanks so much for being with me.
It's great to be with you again, Lisa.
Tell me, Susan, so much of what you do is, I mean, paying attention to national trends, how it translates in the states. You're omnipresent, and the work that you do is really deep and dedicated and thoughtful. I say all that because, you know, right before we get on the phone, I always take just a quick peek to see what it is you've been up to lately, and you've been very busy, my friend.
Primaries lately. The crazy primaries in California last week that were sent shockwaves across the country with the San Francisco District Attorney Boudin's recall. Mm-hmm. And so I'm covering, you know, we're going to be tracking the effect of that crime is having on the midterms in November and these different whether this San Francisco DA Boudin's recall is going to have reverberations at other DAs across the country that were maybe former public defenders or have been had a perceived weakness on crime. So that has been keeping me busy. And then the January 6th hearings, I'm not covering those explicitly, but this week we had an Afghanistan briefing in the middle of the hearings that Republicans and veterans were concerned about, that it was not in a public, it was not in a public forum. It was classified at a very high level. Mm-hmm. So there was a feeling that that was a contrast to what was going on with the with Democrats on January 6th. They were pushing for full transparency when they were trying to, another very bad moment for the Democrats and the Biden administration. They're not providing much transparency at all on with the Afghanistan withdrawal.
Right. I mean, it's been a tremendously busy year overall for news. I mean, really, it feels like many years have been clumped together. But Susan, you've had experience at a lot of different well-named, well-known publications inside of Washington, D.C. Will you talk to me a little bit about your background and how you got into journalism?
Sure. So I came out to D.C. in 1994 with an American Society of Magazine Editors internship, and I was still finishing my degree at University of Southern California, but I decided why finish it in Los Angeles, in the middle of Los Angeles, when you could do it in D.C. So I interned at National Geographic Traveler, and then afterwards I got a job at National Geographic proper, the yellow magazine, which they like to call it, and I really wanted to do magazine journalism, but soon found out that if you really wanted to write, it was going to take very long time to get a real job at National Geographic, and most of their writing is outsourced to expert writers that they've been working for years. So I actually, they were circulating my resume, which is called, in this American Society of Magazine Editors, which is ASME is the shorthand, to different places, and the Washington Times called me, and I decided to go work for the Washington Times because they guaranteed that I'd be interviewing politicians, elected officials right off the bat. And I did. I did. My first interview was with Wendi Graham when Phil Graham was running for president. So that's dating me. That's going back a few years. But it was a really fun, interesting job, and it got me right into the mix. Yeah. And from there, I went to Capital Style magazine, which was kind of a fun kind of Washingtonian type. And it was very similar to George in the way it sort of was irreverent. Mm-hmm. And I loved magazine journalism, even though it's dried up. It's a dying field for journalists. But back then, it was still quite robust, and I loved that job. It was owned by The Economist, and it did fold. And so when it folded, the sister publication, and we shared the same building with, is Roll Call. And I went to work for Roll Call. And that's where I got just the every day in the trenches on the front lines of covering Congress. Really, we had it was before Politico. So it was the inside baseball Politico before that publication. It was where a lot of people, my peers, I think you had Ben Pershing on mm-hmm. before, Chris Saliza, mm-hmm. Mark Preston, who's at CNN, Paul Kane at the Washington Post, Jim Vandehei, we all were there at the same time. Yeah. And I covered I covered a lot of different things at Roll Call. But I covered House Republicans when Tom DeLay was in power. And that was quite an education. So I ended up moving from there to a couple different jobs. I was a Variety's Washington correspondent mm-hmm. for a few years. It kind of bridged my West Coast, East Coast experience.
I bet it did.
I was from Los Angeles, had great invites, got to cover Jack Valenti, the legend who ran the Motion Picture Association. Mm-hmm. And he was wonderful interview. Always quoted Shakespeare with him in every interview.
How about that?
quite a wonderful guy. And, in general, he passed away a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. It was sad for me when he passed away. But so I covered the industry there. I covered the Federal Communications Commission and Congress's regulation of Hollywood and in the gaming industry. It was really interesting, and people get it confused with Vanity Fair and Variety, but it's a quite different publication, so it's more business-oriented. From there, the Hill newspaper needed a number three editor, and they snagged me from there. And I was at the Hill for 11 years. Mm. And yeah, I was number three editor there, mm-hmm. and I was investigative reporter for them. Covered ethics on Capitol Hill, which is always a great beat.
I was gonna say, that's not a slow beat at all.
Yeah, it was the gift that kept on giving yeah. for me. And I ended up going to the Washington Examiner, where I had a lot of friends, and I covered the White House. I had the opportunity to cover the White House directly, so that was during the Obama administration. And I got to be in the briefing room on a regular basis, and so that was quite a treat, and hard too, because I was covering it from a conservative publication and trying yeah. to be fair but tough. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that I did that for a number of years, 4 or 5, and then Real Clear Politics 2019, and I've been here since then.
Talk to me a little bit. So Real Clear is, you know, for those of us inside the Beltway, we know it as a great platform, not only for original reporting, but also aggregating of tremendous news stories and polling. Talk to me a little bit about the philosophy behind the publication itself, though, for folks who maybe aren't as familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, we're known mainly for our polling. When you want to know any politician, be it from Joe Biden, to people facing primary challenges, when you want to know what their approval ratings are, you go to Real Clear Politics and you can track it. We have it graphed out. It's very digestible, easily digestible information. So that's mainly what we're known for. But we've had a great crop of reporters who have worked for Real Clear as well. Right now, there's just a few of us. And what we like to do is, you know, sort of, we have a daily, a person who's at the White House daily. And Phil Wegman, he asks wonderful questions at the White House. If you haven't seen it, he really, he does it in such a way that it's not confrontational, but it's really penetrating. And then we have myself, I provide more of a national perspective since I've been at the White House, but I kind of take a step back and I can cover different trends around the country. And we just do it in a very, our writing is our, an emphasis. Carl Cannon is my editor and he has a Pulitzer and he's a wonderful, wonderful, talented writer and editor. So they, the value is they put a premium on the writing there. And I think it, it really makes the pieces more powerful. And we're much more sort of like a more center right Atlantic, I would think. You know, that's what the, what we're what it's going for right now with our reporting.
And it feels that way. I mean, it really does. I mean, the reporting that you're doing is thoughtful, and it's not it's not, you know, 250 words of the quickest thing that's happening. It's a lot more thoughtful. It's really sort of, to me, it's very reflective of trends and anticipatory of what, you know, this particular episode or event might mean for something else down the road, at least from my vantage point. And that, I think, it seems to me like gives you a little bit more room to be thoughtful about that work.
Yes, and I can do some investigative reporting and actually have time to do it. Which is nice. I don't always do investigative reporting, but you know, you have that liberty. If you have a good idea, you have to pitch it, and they're usually very receptive. And so I have a broad range, and I've, of course, you know, I've been in the business now for going on three decades. It's kind of scary.
That's okay. We're both about the same age, my friend. So we're in it together.
So it's nice to that you have that trust with your editor and that you can sort of pick and choose what you want to cover because there is so much out there. But I like to do things kind of, I like to zig when other people are zagging. So I'm, you know, right now working on a donor story about who's funding so these climate change investigations on Capitol Hill, the PR campaign supporting those. It's kind of, you know, you can, you have time to do the story right. And that's so rare right now.
Absolutely. And I think it's the one thing that, that for the work that you do, it is, to me, perhaps it's not in a magazine, but it does feel a lot like magazine feature, where it's longer and thoughtful, and it's clear to me that you've been given a little time to prepare and report on what it is you're doing.
Yeah, and that's, like I said, if it's not a breaking story, I had to cover some of the primaries this past month or 2 months, and of course you have to do that on a deadline, but it's still in a much more writerly way. It always has improved also in the editing process because Carl is such a good editor. We're much more magazine style if you read myself and fill in some of the other reporters. So we have an investigative side that's purely investigative. So those writers are also really good. They have they have a lot of time. They go into a lot of depth of really deep dives in their reporting, but we are more topical.
Well, I mean, it's great to know that that is there, because there are so few publications that really have that depth and have the ability to really sort of get into that anymore. The whole landscape from the time you and I started has changed so dramatically that, you know, we went from a time where most stories were, you know, had a longer tail, and there was the ability to really sort of report out. Whereas now it's a lot of the chasing of the breaking, and which is fine and important and useful in Washington, but I do think that there is still very much a need for the kind of reporting that you're doing. Tell me a little bit about as you look across, you know, sort of the career that you've had in a lot of different really well-known publications. Is there something that stands out to you as a story or an opportunity perhaps that you really are especially proud of?
Well, you always think about the most recent thing. You're only as good as your last story.
No. Exactly.
I covered, I think the arc of my career was very, was shaped by 9/11.
Yeah.
And I, that day going up, I didn't go up that day. I was at Roll Call, which is kind of a stone's throw from Capitol Hill, a couple mm-hmm. blocks away at the time. And I just remember that day kind of losing your innocence, your face goes white. You see the planes hit the building. Our whole country experienced that. Mm-hmm. And the next day we had to walk up to Capitol Hill, and I was, you knew you were walking towards a target. Mm-hmm. And it was your kind of landscape, your whole landscape had changed, your whole mindset about your innocence and, mm-hmm. you know, your vulnerability changed. So I remember I could give you a funny story about it. So I was going towards the Periacle Press Gallery, and a police officer, this was on the second day, so this is at September 12th. He says, "Get out," and he's using expletives, "Get out." And so I was like, "You don't have to tell me twice. I'm getting out of this building." Uh-huh. So I ran out into what was the south one, I believe, where the visitor center is now. And I was the first person out of the building.
I believe
of the Capitol.
I believe it.
So I was like, yeah, I ran so fast because I was so jittery. And so then they brought out the House Intelligence Committee, and then they brought out the Speaker, Speaker Hastert at the time. And I just remember thinking, oh, I'm not so dumb after all. Okay, I got out. But then after that, you know, it was all constant false suspicious packages. We were running out there a lot.
Yes.
You were on high alert all the time. So I actually covered the creation of the Homeland Security Department. Mm-hmm. I remember Dick Armey was the person who was, you know, limited government. Dick Armey was creating the this mammoth new agency.
Yeah.
And I remember our intelligence failures. I covered all that from a congressional perspective. And then I covered military commissions when we were going after the 9/11 perpetrators. I covered the Guantanamo Bay issues that Feinstein was very involved in, Senator Feinstein. I broke a lot of stories on that issue mm-hmm. with Senator Graham. My most recent story that has come full circle here now. Now we're looking at Afghanistan from a withdrawal point and the chaotic debacle that was.
Yeah.
So I think one of the better stories I've done is the most recent one I've done was last year, and I did a story about the women that received from the State Department Women of Courage Awards. These are Afghan women that stood up to the Taliban. Either they were like cardiologists and they started their own practices during the 20-year our war over there and our support of women in leadership positions, or they were the first elected governor of a section of Afghanistan. And we gave these women Women of Courage Awards from the State Department, and we brought them over to the United States, and they were out at think tanks. Their names and their faces were very visible in the media. And then we left some of them behind, and I didn't name names, but to protect them. And then they've been hiding in safe havens in Afghanistan and trying to get out. And so I covered that in a story last year. And then I've been tracking them ever since, and I'm going to be doing follow-ups on what happened to these women and the people that supported them. I'm in regular touch with some of these individuals that are just amazing. But it's sad. It's really sad to see so much blood, sweat, and toil over within Afghanistan, and then see women return to having to wear burqas and not being able to go to school.
Yeah.
So.
Over the course of 20 years to see such great progress, to only have it go backwards so fast. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I think it's a testament to your work that you're in touch with these people and that you're connecting with them. I'll look forward to reading more about that. I was in New York on 9/12, and because I worked for the governor of New Jersey, and they're as close to New York City, or if not closer than Albany. So mm-hmm. we spent a lot of time. And I feel like when I moved to Washington, I too also had those moments where the Capitol Police would tell us to run for our lives, take off your shoes and run for your lives, because there was an errant airplane headed towards the building or a package or you name it. So I appreciate that so much. And I appreciate that work that you did, because it was on top of having lived through it, you mm-hmm. also reported on it, which I think is also even more of a reminder after the January 6th activities and the insurrection, as it will, also the coverage that came from our colleagues and our friends that were up there in the Capitol for that, and then just hours after and then beyond. It's not necessarily what you were trained for. You were trained to cover politics, and here you are sort of in a very, very different environment. So, but I can imagine that it's very rewarding.
Yeah. It was, you don't have you're not having a choice on what had to be done after 9/11, but you had it was good to be covering from a congressional perspective. I thought about going to Iraq and Afghanistan over the time. I never had the it never came together for me, but that was deeply it was a formative time in my life, and you knew friends that were serving over there, whether it was through the State Department or in a military capacity on the, I don't think that the current generation of reporters has that sort of deep personal connections to the story.
Yes.
And maybe that's good and maybe that's bad, you know, mm-hmm. so, but we definitely lived through it and we don't want to repeat that. Period. So we have an interesting on this war in Ukraine. Have a different perspective than maybe some people do, and because it is you don't want to go too far in getting us into another big war footing.
Yeah. So and long, because it doesn't seem like that's going away anytime soon.
Yes, it's much longer than anybody thought. I think
Absolutely.
They've survived, which is great that they can stand up to Putin. But yeah, it just gives you a little different perspective. You don't want to launch into be jingoistic and just launch into this full you don't want to just get onto a big war footing here with them. But we do want to support Ukraine and stop Putin. But
absolutely.
To what extent are we going to get involved is a big question in my mind.
No, absolutely. And I think it's interesting to see how different administrations sort of take that approach and how they consider all of the factors that are in place. You talked a little bit about the climate change investigation and some of the other things that are going on the Hill. What else? Is there anything else that you're sort of looking forward as we sort of head into the summer? And I mean, COVID sort of ebbs and flows, as we talked about before we even got to record. Is there anything else that you're looking forward to covering over the course of the next couple months? Is it going to be dominated by the primaries? What are you sort of foreseeing for yourself?
Yes, I'm going to be doing another, doing a trip to Arizona in the next couple of weeks. There's a great race that's taking place on the Republican side. There's a Trump-backed candidate, Carrie Lake, who's taking on, who's facing off against another powerful woman on the Republican side. It's like Taylor Robeson, mm-hmm. and she is a big Republican donor. But this is going to be, I think, the next most interesting primary race. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do a little on the ground reporting and see how that debate goes. It's taking place June 29th. So we'll see if, they're going to be facing probably on the Democratic side, the Secretary of State, Katie Hobbs. And so it's going to be a little bit of a rematch like the Georgia race was with Brian Kemp. There's going to be elements of, you know, who supported Trump's recall campaign of the election integrity issue, how much did they support it, what impact that's going to have on the primary and the general race. So I think that'll be a fun one to do.
And all women in the race too, which I can't think of another race where there's on all sides of the challenge, you know, all the challengers and those are, that are coming together will all be female. So that'll be fun to see too.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I thought the race would be interesting as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, so down, and then, certainly I'm looking at, the school shootings. I think the gun legislation on Capitol Hill is very interesting because we've lived through so many of these tragic shootings. And then we see this is the ebb and tide of everyone. The poll numbers are very pro gun control right after the shootings. And then they subside. And it seems like there's a new momentum with after the Uvalde shooting. And people are really, at this point, you see a little bit more momentum. We'll see how it goes. I'm also a mother, so I feel like I'm hoping that's not why I'm really tuned in and think there might be some change. I mm-hmm. also like to see, you know, to track how schools are fortifying themselves in the wake of this, whether we're going to use COVID money, the unspent COVID money to do it. There's ideas out there percolating on Capitol Hill for hardening our schools so that they become safer places. So mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to tracking that as well.
I am too, both professionally and personally. And I think you and I, mm-hmm. as we mentioned early on, we both have friends and family that are teachers, that are obviously not just our own students that live in our homes, but also teachers that are part of our lives that we want to make sure are safe and you know, safeguarded so that there is not this continued terrible news cycle and terrible just tragedies that are happening.
Yes, we went from, I think teachers are live in fear, and that's just terrible. They should be focusing on their students and not have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. So we went from trying to get our kids back in the classroom to now that they're back, we have to worry about basic safety. So I'm interested in how that's going to impact this whole school board issue with that affected the Youngkin race. It seemed to that mm-hmm. parents need more control over the class, what takes place in the classroom, and President Biden saying, I think it was a slip up that he was saying, you know, the teachers really control what takes place in the classroom and the teachers have more control over the kids. And of course, that's a controversial statement. So mm-hmm. I think that the safety issue is going to push that a little bit to the side. And so Republicans are going to have to regroup on that particular issue. Certainly, parents are still upset over what happened during COVID, but we at least have the kids back in the classroom, mostly unmasked, although some masks are coming back mm-hmm. in California and elsewhere. But yeah, now we have to get back to basics with school safety, and I'll be covering some of that. Too.
Never a dull moment for you. Always so busy. But I'm so grateful for all the work that you are doing. Susan, we're getting to the end of our conversation. I mean, we could go on for another hour. So many things to catch up on. But I'm curious, as I build out the podcast, as it continues to grow, I'm always curious, is there someone that you might recommend for a future episode?
Yes, I have. Well, my colleague Phil Wegman is always wonderful. He is one of the brightest stars I have been around. It's not just because we work the same place. I was an editor at The Hill for many years, so I see a lot of raw copy. Mm-hmm. And he's one of the most talented writers, young writers I've seen. So I would recommend him. Awesome. Phil Wegman, he's our White House correspondent.
Okay, he
would be wonderful.
I would love to talk to him, and I'll reach out to him and I'll tell him that you nominated him. Susan, I'm so glad to have had your time today. Thank you so much. Keep up the great work, my friend, and I look forward to catching up again soon.
It's my pleasure, Lisa. I really thank you for the opportunity to speak in, you know, such a thoughtful way.
And that's today's Friday Reporter podcast. A podcast in partnership with PR Daily, a tremendous and helpful guide for all things public relations. Find us there on their website and join us again for another episode soon. Thanks so much.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery, and I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.